Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff Humfeld. Today, we continue our look back at interviews and shows from 2015 that we think are important enough to repeat. On this edition, we replay the whole interview Keith Brown L. conducted with Max Parthas of New Abolitionist Radio about his efforts to strike the duly convicted clause of the 13th Amendment and how those 14 words in the Constitution has led to the massive prison industrial complex and police state we are facing in the U.S. Stay tuned for the calendar of events in the middle of the show and the 420 drug war news at the end of the show. Up next is Keith and his guest, Max Parthas.
This is Keith Brown here from 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio, also Vice Chairman of Missouri Cure. I have Mr. Max Parthas on the phone line from New Abolitionist Radio in South Carolina, and we're going to talk about the 13th Amendment to the United States Constitution and how it relates to private prisons, industrial complexes that are rapidly spreading all over America. Now, I wonder, could you give our audience a little bit of background about yourself and what it is you do, sir?
Yeah, my name is Max Parthas, as you said. I'm one of the hosts of New Abolitionist Radio on the BlackTalkRadioNetwork.com, along with Scotty Reed, who is the founder of the Black Talk Radio Network, and also with Yohanan Elia, who is one of our researchers, does a lot of work there. And what we do is we explain every week using both history and current events and linking them together to show people how modern-day slavery is occurring right in front of our faces right now on a scale that may even surpass what happened during the 1800s. This is just right there in our faces, and it's all being exploited primarily through the 13th Amendment, which was its intention when it was written, with an exception clause for prisoners. And we show people how that works in today's system. It's relatively new, as I might have mentioned to you before. Didn't really come into being as we know it until Richard Nixon started the war on drugs, which was followed by the next president, Ronald Reagan, bringing in the first private prisons. And since then, these private prisons have become global entities. I mean, huge global private corporations that rival our largest corporations in the world right now. And it's only happened in 45 years. And during that time, with their growth, we've seen also the reflected growth of the prison population going from 230,000 prisoners nationwide to 2.5 million in this country alone.
What has been the response to the efforts that you've been putting forth?
Well, we've been working on it for a number of years, but I must admit that the enemy, and I'll just say it like that, the enemy is those who want to see us enslaved, have been putting their foots in their mouths. They really, their pure greed has exposed them on so many levels that the common person is starting to see it and accept it. As an artist and a spoken word artist, I get to go around and talk to people, and I see the reaction that they have to it. Most people already understand. They already know. And when you give them that little bit of extra information, it all clicks together. And then their perspective changes. And we're seeing that change in perspective take on a national appearance now through movements like the Black Lives Matter movement and other organizations like that, who are deciding at this point that we no longer want to deal with this type of oppression anymore. We want to see an end to it. As far as the abolitionist movement, that is also gaining good ground on the Move to Abolish 21st Century group. We've got over 2,000 people who are professed abolitionists there, and we work together to make changes throughout our own networks. And our radio station, New Abolitionist Radio, reaches something like 32 countries every week and tens of thousands of listeners.
Are you making any headway with the politicians over here in this country?
We've made headway with at least two. Most of our opposition comes from politics, to be honest with you, and that's mainly because very many of the politicians of America today are invested in private prisons. Hillary Clinton's primary fundraisers right now are former lobbyists for the GEO group. So that's what we're running across when it comes to politicians. Many of the states have their own version of the exception clause.
We spoke about this a little earlier. From what I understand, you're saying that this really took on a life of its own when Nixon came into office, but this exception clause in the 13th Amendment, it's always been in place. Is that correct?
Yes, it's always been there. And it has has always been exploited, just not to the degree that we see it now, to abolish convict leasing. So it was always going on. It was the go-to for slavery. The moment that slavery supposedly ended, the prison leasing began. So it was literally switching from the individual plantation owner or just plain old white guy being able to own human beings as property to the state taking over through the prisons and using the same tactics without any of the concern.
Okay, what is your assessment of the recent visit of President Obama to some of these prisons and his releasing some of the prisoners who had been incarcerated for crack cocaine and some of the comments and actions that have been taken by the Department of Justice lately regarding the prison population?
Well, let me first put it like this. If the only thing you're proposing, whoever you are in politics, is reform, then by default you are saying there is no such thing as another option. And there is another option, the other option being abolition. The president is very much fully aware of the circumstances we find ourselves in. And I say that because I personally heard him speak about it to students, I believe, out of Princeton University. I think I'm not 100% sure on that part, but I remember seeing him speak to it about to these students where he was explaining that he had the Emancipation Proclamation right behind his desk, and he's seen it every day. And he explained how, at the time, it only applied when Lincoln gave it out was to those in opposition of the North. So it didn't apply to the North. The North was allowed to keep their slaves, so it didn't really emancipate all the slaves. And then he went on further to saying that if it happened right now, Huffington Post would be calling it a betrayal. Like, look, Lincoln betrays all blacks. So he knows what's going on and what happened at that period of time. He's in opposition to abolition. See, as I mentioned earlier, these prison industrial complex giants are global now. They are huge entities, and many of them are directly in bed with a lot of our politics. Just between the years of 2002 and 2012, prison lobbyists spent $48 million just on lobbying efforts alone. So by default, what he's doing is saying there's no other thing. All we can do is reform. And he visited this prison, first president to visit a prison, and that's beautiful. It brought a lot of attention to the circumstances, and then they released 46. But while he was releasing these 46, his attorney general was working within the courts to keep 5,000 others in for the same reasons. I don't have any faith these days in our government. I don't care if it's the president or Congress or Senate. From what I've seen and the proof that we've shown, that most of them are in bed, and those who are not in bed with these private prisons are afraid to speak up to the others, because this is the type of information that makes people lose their lives. This type of information that people will be assassinated for. You're talking about a $2 trillion industry that is embedded in everything we do.
Which attorney general were you referring to a while ago?
Eric Holder.
Okay. Now, what's your assessment of the new attorney general that we have? Or have you had an opportunity to evaluate her position?
I haven't had a full chance to evaluate her, but I do know that she is against legalizing marijuana. And for me, that says a lot right there. When 50% of all the drug arrests made in this country last year was over marijuana, and still we have several states that have legalized it and are making fortunes on it, but you want to continue arresting more minorities and people in poverty over a natural plant. It doesn't make sense to me, and it kind of tells me where her allegiances lie.
Now, without compromising plans or strategies in the abolitionist movement, can you tell us about some of the work that people that you are involved with are doing to try to combat the situation?
Certainly. I could tell you on several levels. We believe in the death by a thousand cuts ideal, meaning that, as I mentioned to you before, everybody has a part to play. They can use their talents in any way they can, and we don't always have to agree on what it is that we're all doing, just like John Brown might not have agreed with Frederick Douglass and vice versa. You know, everybody played their part, but these things have to happen. So in just the past couple years, we've seen divestment programs like Columbia Divest, which I've mentioned earlier, get the university to divest from investments in the constructions of private prisons. We've seen the teachers unions move towards the same thing because they also have $100 million almost collectively invested into the construction of private prisons. So we've seen a movement within that to get divestments from there. And this is also followed up with many of the companies who use prison slave labor being boycotted to the point where McDonald's, the last I heard, which is one of these companies, has decided they're closing like 600 of their stores. So they're losing a lot of business and a lot of money behind that. So it's hurting them in their pockets with efforts like that, with ourselves and our allies working together to do these things. We've also been able to inspire other attorneys, speaking with other attorneys and attorney organizations, who are now starting to use RICO charges as well, racketeering charges against elements of the prison industrial complex like Unicor, which is a, I believe it's almost a $900 million a year industry based on prison slave labor. So from what I heard, they're being sued now for employing the largest number of illegal aliens in the United States, close to 5,000 illegal aliens who are employed by Unicor, making goods and services that are being sold on the open market. And right now in Mississippi, the former longest-running head of the corrections department of the prisons there in Mississippi, I believe his name is Christopher Epps, is at the moment facing a life term in prison for corruption. Previously, he was facing 366 years. They had found out there that the whole state was being used as his private money generator, working with a local judge slash businessman slash legislator. And that is ongoing right now. So they're falling back for the first time in many, many years. And I think this is the first time we've seen no growth in the prison system since it began. So that's a couple of elements. And then the final elements is we're pushing people to start legislation to remove any slavery language from their state constitutions, and also hopefully to eventually get it removed from the federal constitution. Some states have strange language, like Georgia's constitution says that you can be enslaved or put into indebted servitude for contempt of court. Sounds pretty ridiculous, but it's actually in the Georgia state constitution. So we're attacking those ridiculous things. We're trying to take those out, and we're trying to put in anti-slavery language that says slavery shall be abolished, period. No exceptions.
You mentioned something earlier about Columbia Divest. Could you explain who they are and what they do?
Columbia Divest was a group of students that got together, I believe, almost 2 years ago, and just found out that Columbia University was invested into the construction of private prisons through, I guess, their investment firms, like one called Vanguard. The Vanguard Group is one of the largest investors. So they were invested into this in upwards in the tens of millions, and the students thought that that was a direct conflict of interest, that a center for education should be invested in how many of their students end up in prison, which it is. And for a year and a half, almost 18 months, they pushed and pushed and pushed for meetings with the deans and directors there, and they finally got one and convinced them to divest from their prison investments.
Once again, you're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. This is Jaws of Justice Radio. My name is Keith Brownhill, and I'm talking with Mr. Max Parthas in South Carolina, who is from New Abolitionist Radio, and we are talking about slavery and the prison industrial complexes here that exist in America. Mr. Parthas, has there been any incidents of retaliation, government retaliation or corporation retaliation by any of the people that you know are involved in the New Abolitionist movements and the movement to eradicate the slavery exception clause in the 13th Amendment?
Yes, there has been. My family and I have faced certain threats over the years. In particular, we've had police show up at our house while I was on the air, like I'm on a conversation with you right now. I was on the air doing New Abolitionist Radio, and I live in a little town in the middle of nowhere, built back in 1880, and there's only two houses, well, there were three, but there's only two houses on the block right now, and I'm at the dead end. And the police knocked on my door saying that they were called anonymously because of a domestic abuse report. And my wife and I have been together 27 years. We love each other like we are newlyweds. There is no domestic abuse or nothing like that going on here. So it really didn't make any sense. But 1 week after that, the house across the street from us burst into flames while I was, again, on air. And we saw the police driving off. And the fire department didn't show up for almost an hour. They just let it burn. So that tells me there's some dangerous things going on. Even right now, my wife is being charged, or they're attempting to charge my wife with fraud over SNAP for collecting 3 months or 6 months worth of assistance with food when our granddaughter was born. And they're trying to get around fraud of that. This is the type of things that they'll do to retaliate. You know, they are embedded within the system.
Have there been other incidents or just these two pertaining to you and your family?
You mean with other people being involved?
Yes.
Yes, yes. Scotty Reed has also faced certain threats, as well as I believe he's gotten death threats. And I know Johanan is at the point now, because of what he's been doing out there, that he has great concerns for himself and his family safety. He says that every Sunday he takes a trip and there's a cop out there just picking up black people, you know, like they did Sandra Bland. And he's just wondering when it's going to be him, you know. But we also know that out in Milwaukee and people that aren't associated with us out in Milwaukee, for instance, the sheriff out there issued warrants on the arrest of organizers with no evidence or no judge signing off, just literally issued warrants on the organizers out there. And we've seen that tactic used a lot, where organizers are being targeted for small things which lead to big things.
Well, while I have this subject on the board, I want to take the time to let you know that those of us who appreciate what you do are grateful for the risks and the sacrifices that you are taking, sir.
Thank you, brother.
Now, can you name some of the corporations that are involved in some of these private prison corporations?
Yes. As a matter of fact, in 2013, 37 states passed legislation that would allow prisons in their states to offer their labor services to private corporations, international private corporations, and many took advantage of that and had already been taking advantage of that. Some of the names would be Walmart, McDonald's, Burger King, Wendy's, Victoria's Secret at one point was being made by prisoners. So we're talking about the women's lingerie was being made in a South Carolina prison where they were paying the people to make it 35 cents an hour. So that's just a few. But if you just do a simple Google search, because of the information that we've been able to push out these days, it's easily located now. Just do like a keyword search of companies using prison labor, and you'll have pages and pages, hundreds of names long, even insurance companies and also other like telephone companies where you have these call centers that are built into prisons where the prisoners are sitting there taking the calls for services. So you might be calling up to have your computer checked out or get some kind of tech information and find out you don't know if you're talking to somebody who isn't doing 30 to life. you don't know. And they're making like pennies on the dollar, $28 a month, I believe, on the average.
What are there any private prisons in your state?
Yes, South Carolina is working with private prisons here, particularly a youth detention facility owned and operated by a company called CEC, which is Community Education Center. And they're charging to keep those kids in there $161,000 a year, per child, per year.
What do you think about the judges and other politicians that come out and speak out about the prison overcrowding situations? And some of them are coming out and they're telling people that we can't continue to incarcerate people at the rate that we have been doing. We have to think about starting letting some of these people out on the street. Is this just lip service, or do you think that there are some people out there who genuinely are trying to find a solution to this problem?
I think that it's possible there are people out there who genuinely are trying to find solutions. And I also think that it's possible that those same people who are trying to find solutions have not come to grips with even the concept that slavery might never have been ended, and that this might actually be chattel slavery all over again, and that this whole system might be funneling a bunch of people through its prisons for no other reason than it makes them profit and funds their budgets, and that it gives jobs. So they haven't considered that. They're still thinking that reform is the only option. So they think within the constraints of that one box being reform. And the truth is, you can't reform genocide and you can't reform slavery. And that's what we're dealing with. And that's the hardest thing that people have when it comes to accepting a simple truth. If you just start looking at it as in a slave trade, everything starts making sense. But that requires that people overcome cognitive dissonance, which is what happens when something goes completely against everything you've ever been taught. Even our most intelligent and wonderful historians who have studied slavery for their whole lives and taught it for 20 or 30 years, if you just get them in a corner and say, listen, explain to me what this 13th Amendment exception clause means, you'll get a lot of stuttering and I don't knows from people who have done this all their lives because it's not something they want to face.
Now, we're not talking about abolishing the 13th Amendment in its entirety. All we're talking about is eliminating the exception clause that you're speaking of, right?
That's it. Just taking out the exception clause. Give me the white out. I'll do it for you. That's all it takes. Just take out the exception clause. The exception clause allows prisons to be plantations. It's really just that simple. It says slavery shall be abolished in the United States and all its territories except for prisoners duly convicted. And as I stated, in states like Georgia, they even allow for you to be a slave for contempt of court, and it's been used. So once you become property of the state, you are theirs to do whatever they want with. People go through sexual abuse. As we know, the United States leads the way in male rape, primarily because of our prison system. So in the entire world, more men get raped in the United States than anywhere else. So they're dealing with that. They're also dealing with the physical abuse that you would expect to come with slavery. They're dealing with the trade-offs where human trafficking is involved, where some prisons will ship their prisoners from point A to point B in another state in order to fill quotas or beds or even to pull up the numbers of their voting populace because those people get counted in the census. So this is human trafficking that they're dealing with that you would expect from slavery. Every brutality, every atrocity that you can imagine that goes with slavery happens within our prison and justice system. And our police right now have the mentalities of slave catchers because that's what they're out there to do. When you see them pull over a Sandra Bland or when you see them stop someone who really shouldn't be stopped at all to fill a quota, the quota ultimately leads to two things occurring. One, you get exploited. You have to pay these fines, and if you can't pay these fines, there is a second stage that occurs, which is imprisonment, where they start making money on your body being stored. So one of the reasons why Sandra Bland was brought in on a Friday, because she couldn't get out, she had to stay in for a few days and make that money for them until Monday.
Now, what would you say to people who say that we have to have prisons to prevent anarchy from erupting in this society? What would be your answer to the current system that we have in place? If we were to do away with abolish all the private prisons or the other prisons, what would we replace that with?
Basically, 70 to 80% of the prisoners who are in jail right now don't deserve to be there. There are many other ways to deal with the problems of our nation other than locking everybody up. We do need prisons. We need them for crazy folk who will go out and shoot up entire high schools or movie theaters or serial rapists or pedophiles, those people who need to be separated from the rest of the population. Of course, we need prisons for that. But that would only be a small percentage. Where we have places like California that has 33 prisons, we could bring it down to 2 and it would be plenty.
What good would it do to abolish most of the prisons that we have if we still have so much corruption in the police department and people who are in the mindset that we need to just lock as many people up as we can and throw away the key because this is the only real solution to crime?
When you get rid of the prisons like that, you no longer have a need for all these people hunters out there. You no longer have a need for unlicensed hunters by the names of bail bondsmen who go out with nothing more than a freaking gun and the will to do so and hunt people. You no longer have those needs, so you can eventually start going from 1 million officers nationwide to somewhere around 200,000 to do the same job. Crime isn't so rampant because it became out of a vacuum. This over-policing is causing the crime. It's pushing people into abject poverty where they're losing their menfolk, their womenfolk, their children are spending so much time in jails they never have a chance to take care of a community. So you're really causing this, perpetuating this cycle to happen over and over and over again. And after 3 or 4 generations, you pretty much wiped out an entire community.
Well, that sounds like that would translate into a lot of mass unemployment if these people are no longer needed to go out and do the things that they do to keep these prisons full. Now, what do you propose that we do to try to remedy that problem?
Well, you're absolutely right. In our research, doing a series called America is Ferguson, which kind of uses the framework of the DOJ report on Ferguson, where we inspect every single state week after week, in alphabetical order, we found that there are so many jobs revolving around slavery that would blow your mind. There's some states that employ upwards of 30 and 40,000 people for no other reason than to keep this system going within their state. It's a huge job generator. Right here in South Carolina, there are 7,000 people directly employed by the prison industries. So, yeah, there would be a lot of people losing jobs in slavery, just like there was a lot of people losing jobs in slavery in 1865. Now, one of the ways that we could solve that problem and at the same time restore the communities that we have destroyed is the industry that we're taking down, as I mentioned before, is valued in the trillions. If we seize those assets, if we seize those monies that they have illegally gotten using human trafficking and slavery, and we liquidate them, there would be more than enough to, A, start educating and help providing for the community's restorations, and B, to start bringing our own manufacturing back here into the United States where people can get jobs and don't have to do it by hunting other people. We don't need no more hunting scalps for a penny that the government will pay you. That has to end. But we do need manufacturing and jobs. And our manufacturing was taken out during the Reagan and the Nixon era, if you remember, as a way to gain cheap labor in third world countries. Now, that manufacturing has come back again to a small degree, but because it can now use prison labor instead. That has to end. That's all part of slavery and human trafficking. We can make the things that we need right here, and we can pay people a living wage without having to keep seeking for the cheapest dollar that we can exploit from anybody. So, yeah, there are at least two ways of solving that economic problem of people losing jobs. As I said, the money you would seize from these criminals is huge. And B, bring manufacturing back. Let's put people back to work.
Now, the calendar for January 4th, 2016. One Struggle KC and Moore Squared are sponsoring a rally in response to the recent comments from the KC Police Department indicating that the 47 police killings of citizens over the past 10 years are acceptable and that the Kansas City community supports the police actions. These groups and others will meet in front of the new East Patrol Station at 27th and Prospect, KCMO, from 4:30 to 5:30 p.m. today, Monday, January 4th. This joint action serves as a public display that the community does not condone the 47 police killings. Please dress warmly if you plan to attend. You can find out more by going to the Not One More KCPD Killing page on Facebook. The Criminal Justice Task Force will meet Monday, January 4th from 6:45 to 8:45 p.m. at the Church of the Good Shepherd, 4947 Choteau Drive, KCMO. The Criminal Justice Task Force mission is to lobby the Missouri State Legislature for sentencing laws that are fair and humane. You are invited to bring a friend and some non-perishable food items for the after-school backpack program. For information, contact Robin Johnson at 816-522-4081 or email redrob, that's R-E-D-R-O-B, 2655 at yahoo.com. The Kansas City Chapter of Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty will meet Tuesday, January 5th from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church, 4501 Walnut, KCMO. They will be finalizing plans for their upcoming workshop, Death to the Death Penalty, to be held Saturday, January 23rd from 9 a.m. to noon at St. Mark's Union Church, 1101 Euclid, KCMO. The Kansas City Chapter of Empower Missouri's First Friday Forum will be Friday, January 8th, 1130 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Westport Flea Market, 817 Westport Road, KCMO. They will be taking a look at the prospects for legislation in the 2016 Missouri legislative session with Director Jeanette Mott Oxford. Mothers of Incarcerated Sons and Daughters will have their monthly meeting Saturday, January 9th from noon to 2 p.m. at the Waldo Branch Library, 201 East 75th Street, KCMO. If you have a loved one that is incarcerated and need advice and support, MISD has members that may be able to help. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Next week on Jaws of Justice Radio, host Robin Martinez assembles a panel of legal minds to look back at some of the important stories of 2015. Now, back to Keith and his guest, Max Parthas.
Once again, you're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. This is Jaws of Justice Radio. My name is Keith Brownhill, and I'm talking with Mr. Max Parthas in South Carolina, who is from New Abolitionist Radio, and we are talking about slavery and the prison industrial complexes here that exist in America. If the abolitionist movement is successful, it sounds like it would not only result in a lot of job cuts in the police departments, but it would also reduce the number of jobs available for judges, parole officers, prison guards, a lot of government jobs that make their living off people being incarcerated.
Yes, and that's some of our biggest opposition. Like, the police unions have humongous voting power and influence on the government, and they often fight any change that would reduce the number of policemen or prison guards. Instead, they want more jobs. They want more money. They want more raises. They want more of this, more, and that just leads to more enslavement. So, yeah, there would be a lot of people who would have to start all over again because those jobs would no longer be available. But let's keep it real. You're ending slavery. You don't need to do anything else to help slavery continue. You shouldn't take that personal. You should be thankful that you don't have to participate in a system of enslavement anymore. And if things go in the way we abolitionists would like them to go, you don't have to wait long. The money's going to be available for us to start putting things right real soon.
Well, it certainly makes a lot of sense to me. I would hope that it's practical because it's not like society doesn't need it. The question I want to ask you now is, like, what role do you feel that the black judges and police officers, parole officers and different people, do you feel like they kind of help offset some of the oppression that's being unleashed against black people in this country as far as the incarceration rate is concerned? Or are they just merely contributing to the problem?
Well, there are a couple of exceptions to the rules. I believe Ken Thompson out in Brooklyn DA, that he's a good man. He's really been trying to overturn a lot of these cases that were done. I believe that, I don't know if it was John Burge or one of these crooked detectives who was responsible for, like, the Central Park Five, who were all framed for that and spent their lifetimes in prison for something they had never done. He had done that to a lot of people out there, and this brother's out overturning those convictions and getting those people free. So I got to give props to him in that instance. But on the other hand, I do know that there's a lot of people of color who are directly involved in the maintenance and willingly making this happen. As I mentioned earlier, Christopher Epps would be one of them. He was running the entire state of Mississippi's prison systems, including its juvenile prisons, and federal judges visited these prisons and said they were cesspools of constitutional violations. And at the same time that the judges were making these decisions, he was getting a 100% efficiency report from a group that monitors prisons and how well they fit requirements. But apparently nobody was told that Christopher Epps himself was the one that was giving out these reports. So he was giving himself 100% rating reports while the people in his prisons were being abused, suffered, over-prison population, just all the terrors that you can think about in a Mississippi prison that is a cesspool of constitutional violations was happening so he could make some money. And he was making money hand over fist with condominiums as gifts and Mercedes as gifts. And at one point, he was reported, and I believe they have all the listings of the banks that he went to, going from bank to bank to bank, depositing $9,000 at each bank. The man was in love with money, but at the expense of the freedom of his people. So I don't trust somebody and their intentions based on what their color is or what they associate with. It's their actions that determine who's good and who's bad at this point in time, particularly when it comes to police, because I've found and studies have shown that policemen of color are more likely to be more brutal than their white counterparts.
I agree. I agree 100%. But what I was referring to a while ago, I think when we did our pre-interview, you spoke to me about an officer you had a conversation with, and he told you that if it wasn't for people like him out there, the...
Yes. That's what the other story that I want to tell. I got a little off track. I'm sorry. I get talking sometimes. I was at the July 18th Push Black event where the KKK were coming to stand under the flag, as they normally do, these racist militias. Unfortunately, their flag wasn't there this time because we had assisted in taking that down, and it was... that happened on July 10th. But July 18th, the KKK came out there, and all these various black organizations came out there, and had the opposition, as well as white people came out in opposition to the KKK. And while we were there, there was 300-400 armed police and with some of the best gear available, that military-style gear you can imagine. And I'm walking amongst them with a couple of witnesses from the Quakers organizations, the Friends organizations, to see what was going on. And we ran across one young policeman. I guess he must have been about 30 or 33, around that age, a brother. And we talked for a while, and I started presenting him with the information that I think most of our police force lacks. That's, first of all, that they don't know there's a 13th Amendment exception clause, that just like most other people, the Constitution that they swore to protect, they've never read.
Right.
At least not that part. So we present them with that evidence, and then I told them also about how 90% of all prosecutors are white, and 79% of them are white males. And I also presented to him about how many people are sitting right now waiting in jails for trials are primarily people of color, almost 90% black and Hispanic, as just to show him what he's contributing to. And then I asked him at one point, I said, we're going to need brothers like you to stand up one day and just say no, that you don't want to participate in this system in the way that they propose you participate. I mean, if you see somebody who has the opportunity, or you may be able to send them to prison because you just stopped them for a taillight and they've got a $50 outstanding warrant, maybe you should say no once in a while. And eventually it led to this brother copping a plea and simply saying, look, man, I'm just trying to do my job. That's all.
Mm-hmm. It's always the excuse. I'm following orders. I'm doing my job.
Yeah, it's always the excuse. I'm just doing my job. You got to stop doing your job. I mean, you got to wonder, like, I always try to think in another person's shoes, and I do that because I'm a poet and an artist, so it makes sense for me to try to be in someone else's shoes. And I think, what would it feel like to be the type of guy who was employed by the power company, for instance, and your only job is to go out and shut off people's lights or gas or heat in the winter, and you show up and you see 5 or 6 kids running around in the yard, and a woman's there by herself, and they look poor, and like they can barely buy bread, let alone pay for this $300 bill, and what do? You turn off their power. How do you live like that? I don't understand it. I could not do something like that. What about you, Keith?
Well, I think I'd have to wrestle with myself to be able to do that. But I think with most people, they look at the situation that they see these people in and they think, well, if I don't do the job that I'm hired to do, then I'm going to be in that same situation because I won't have a job.
Doesn't that sound like a threat to you?
I would use the word oppression.
Yeah.
But that brings me to the next question I'd like to ask you. Do you think that if all of the police that we had in this country and all the judges and what have you, all of them stood up at one time and said, hey, we're not going to do things like we've been doing them in the past. We're going to refuse to do this. Do you think that we have enough people that have been integrated into the system to make a difference? Do you think that anything would change if that was the case? Or would they just simply be eliminated and replaced by other people who were willing to do their job?
Well, just like we found out amongst the citizenry, that once we stand up together, then people have no choice but to listen. We force ourselves into the conversation. And that's what the police need to do amongst themselves. They really need to start policing themselves. You can't keep talking about good cops now. The system is too dirty to use that claim of good cop. The only good cop is one who is opposing the criminality of what's being involved publicly, physically, in any way, shape, or form you can. So if we were to get a division in that organization, within the police organization itself, where maybe 50% of the cops say, look, we're tired of this. We don't want to do this to our brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers and sons and daughters anymore. My kids got to grow up in that neighborhood. I don't want them to grow up in this type of environment. and they start saying no, then maybe we can get some changes, because they can only keep doing these things to us because we let them. And when I say we, I mean our brothers and sisters who are part of the system. You're a part of the system. You know, don't walk out after 17 years and then denounce it. Do it before you leave. Don't leave the system in good condition. Wreck it before you leave.
All right, I have another question I want to ask you, and this may sound like something I've already asked you during the interview. In the state of Missouri, the number of prisoners that have death sentences, life without parole or life for 50 years, is almost 3,000. The total number of prisoners is over 32,000. Those with long sentences are those who probably should be kept off the street. What about the others? What would be the alternative?
The first thing that we have to do throughout our prison systems and all our prisoners, no matter how long it takes, is review all of their records, because we found that a lot of people don't belong in prison. Examples would be the circumstances that happened with the young woman out in Massachusetts. Her name was Annie Dukin, who was responsible for falsifying upwards of 60,000 false drug and alcohol reports. And she had done it for profit, and she had done it for 14 years. And it affected somewhere upwards of 8,000 people's records, some of them who went to jails and prisons. So we have to, and we also know that there's a lot of corruption involved in our judicial arenas and in our prosecutorial arenas and in our law enforcement arenas. So we really need to take a closer look at who's left and why they're there and what their status has been up to this point. I don't think people deserve to spend their entire lives in prison without the chance of parole unless you know for certain that that is somebody who cannot be functioning within the community at any point. And even then, you still need to check it out every few years just to see how they're growing, because people do change. They do change.
Well, it seems to me that if we could combat some of the corruption that's taking place within the system before we get to prison, that would automatically eliminate a lot of the need to incarcerate people in so many prisons that we have already in the country, and would automatically make the prisons go down.
Oh, absolutely. One of the ways that, as I mentioned earlier, if we bring back manufacturing and if we take those assets that have been exploited from the peoples themselves and return them back to building the communities, we're going to have a lot less crime. Poverty breeds crimes. And our lawmakers tend to make a lot of things illegal, from sleeping on the streets of the homeless person or urinating in the public as a homeless person to buying a $5 bag of marijuana, whatever it may be. Even sagging pants have been made illegal. But these things are bred within areas of poverty, and we all know that. And the police surround these areas and hunt in them like they're big game fields. And that's where they get most of their population that goes into these prisons. They don't get them from affluent neighborhoods. They get them from places that are in poverty. And again, it goes back to creating that vicious cycle where they become more impoverished to the point where finally gentrification occurs, where just about everybody who was there is gone, and now new people are moving in. Detroit would be an example of that, the mass exodus from Detroit, and then the Chinese buying up all the property, and now the whites are moving back into Detroit getting this free property. So we keep perpetuating this system of poverty using the police forces, who are taking out the biggest resource from the community. If we got rid of all of those problems, and we could do that in one sweeping move. I really believe that we can do this in one sweeping move by abolishing slavery from this country forever, and then banning private prisons that have been exploiting them, and then finally looking at the federal prisons and seeing to what degree they have been exploiting them and how we can now reform what is left of our prisons after slavery has been abolished.
What do you see as the immediate solution to all of these police killings that we are having here on the streets that seem to be targeting black people? We have occasions where that occurs where white people are killed as well, and it seems like they're unjustified. But what could you possibly propose as a meaningful solution to those problems?
At this point, I don't know if we're going to have a choice anymore about what to do for the immediate change. Louis Farrakhan is taking that out of many people's hands right now, and I can't blame him. On October 10th, 2015, there's going to be the 20th anniversary, right, of the Million Man March?
Right.
And he's called out already. It's too late. He's already called out for at least 10,000 people willing to give their lives for this cause, who are tired of living under oppression and feel it would be sweeter to see death than to continue to watch their children and their women and their men be slaughtered and collected like animals to feed this beast. And I believe that call has been accepted by many. So on 10-10-2015, he said justice or else, and that the federal government has to come in right now and do something to make a change or else. It's been a long time since we said or else, because we forgot how to say or else. We just let things happen, and then we try to work within the very same system that is oppressing us in order to correct it. Well, he stepped outside of that box, and I don't know how America is going to react, and I don't know what they're going to do about it, but I do know with or without Farrakhan at this point, a lot of people are showing up on 10-10-2015, and many have heard the call. So I would say that the federal government now needs to take a close look at what they can do, because it's not about our choices anymore when this type of decision has already been made. And as I said, I can't fault them. People are tired of us dying. Look at the incident right now in Mississippi with the young brother out there who was stopped by a policeman and ended up killing the policeman. Then he went on a run. They put this huge manhunt together. He turned himself in after they called him a coward and said, look, I'm not a coward. Here I am. Well, nobody's released any information on how that case went out. We haven't seen any dash cam footage. We don't know if that was another Sandra Bland case or another of the hundreds of cases where police have overstepped their bounds during normal traffic violations that normally would lead to the citizen's death. In this case, it led to a policeman's death. We also know that Mississippi is embroiled in corruption within their police community right now. At least three of their police officers have been charged with murder and are facing murder charges. Another one was charged with extortion. Another one was caught going around forcing women to give him blowjobs at gunpoint. So this is happening within the police department itself. So it's kind of hard to say, what can we do? As I said, those things may be taken out of our hand. We'll see on 10-10-2015 if change is going to happen or else is going to happen.
I'm sure you've heard this expression. I've heard it many times when I was coming up. I heard my parents say that if we don't watch it, they're going to put us right back in slavery. Do you think we've reached that point at this stage where we are actually back in slavery?
That is the part where I tend to have a different view than many others, and that is the click moment that I try to put into other people's head. It never stopped. There was no back in slavery. Slavery never ended at any point, nowhere in history. The exception clause was placed into the 13th Amendment. The emancipation only freed the slaves in the South. So there was no point. And then the switchover using the prison industrial complex or convict leasing, whatever they called it at that time throughout history, continued on to this date. The explosion of slavery becoming a global entity once again began basically in 1970. Now we're here. Slavery is alive. It's happening. It's real. It's just like the slavery of 1865, if not possibly worse and bigger. And that's the perspective that we have to adopt. That's the radical change we're looking for. Once we accept that slavery never ended and that what we're dealing with right now is slavery and it needs to be abolished, we think of that differently, we see it differently, we fight it differently, and we'll end it using different ideas. It's just a matter of changing your mind. But if you continue to keep giving all these issues various synonyms for slavery, like mass incarceration, and yesterday I heard a new one, policeteering, policing for profit, prison for profit, punishment for sale, racial injustice in the justice system, and so many other names, then you're going to keep chasing shadows. We have to come to an agreement on what we're dealing with, and then we have to face that problem, and then we can beat it. But as long as we're just making up names as we go along because we refuse to see the truth, we're not going to get very far.
Okay, now could you tell us how can people find your radio broadcast and where could you be located at?
Well, that's a good thing to ask, as a matter of fact, because I'd like to announce that we just launched a new website called thenewwordorder.com. You think the New World Order? We're the New Word Order, and we've compiled all of the information that we can present to people right there in a simple website, thenewwordorder.com. You'll find New Abolitionist Radio there, as well as many other links, resources, and people that you can link up with to get involved and to help. We've also found and presented many pieces of evidence that could, how do prosecutors say it, that would convince a ham sandwich or convict a ham sandwich.
Right.
Well, we've got all of that there. We spent years gathering this information together for you on every level. And all you got to do is go to thenewwordorder.com and you can find everything we do right there put together in a very simple way for you to be able to absorb it at any speed you'd like. I would highly suggest starting with the featured video in the center, which is called I Denounce This So-Called Emancipation as a Stupendous Fraud. That is the title of the essay that was written by Frederick Douglass in 1888 when he denounced the emancipation, something most people don't even know ever happened. But he did denounce it almost 30 years after it went into place. And we had a few very special people come together and recite his words and tie it in together with current events so you could see what he saw then. I would start there.
I certainly wish I had more time to sit down and talk with you about this in length, sir. It's a pleasure doing this interview with you, and we'll do everything we can to help you get the word out, and we appreciate you doing what you do, and it's needed.
Can I just say one more thing to this, as a final statement, I guess?
Yes.
This is for our young people out there. Just do two things for me. Stay free and stay alive. Whatever that may take, stay free and stay alive. They don't need a reason to get you. They're trying to get you. Just stay out of their clutches. Don't even go near policemen these days. For the family members, don't call cops on your family members, because we know how that often turns out. Please try to handle your situations as best you can. Stay free and stay alive. We need you. Thank you very much, and I appreciate you, my brother Keith. And peace to 90.1 FM.
Thank you, sir.
Our thanks to Mr. Max Parthas of New Abolitionist Radio. You can find out more about Max and his research at newwordorder.com. That's newwordorder.com.
It's the 420 Drug War News, and this is U.S. presidential candidate Bernie Sanders.
In 2014, the latest statistics that I have seen, there were 620,000 arrests for marijuana possession. That is one arrest every minute. According to a report by the American Civil Liberties Union, there were more than 8 million marijuana arrests in the United States from 2001 to 2010. Almost 9 in 10 of those arrests were for possession. Arrest for marijuana possession rose last year nationwide, even as Colorado, Washington, Oregon, Alaska, and the District of Columbia became the first states to legalize personal use of marijuana. And let us be clear, as is the case in many other areas, that there is a racial component to this situation. Although about the same proportion of blacks and whites use marijuana, a black person is almost four times more likely to be arrested for marijuana possession than a white person. Too many Americans have seen their lives destroyed because they have criminal records as a result of marijuana use. That is wrong. That has got to change. Let's be clear, but I think a lot of people may not fully appreciate this, is that a criminal record could mean not only time in jail, but a criminal record makes it harder for a person to get a job, harder for a person to get public benefits, harder for a person to even get housing. A criminal record stays with a person for his or her entire life. It is a serious business.
Again, that was U.S. Presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. Did you notice the roar of applause when he said we've got to get rid of these records for marijuana possession? It's time for other politicians to snap to and realize it's a way to get votes. We'll have part two of this from Bernie Sanders on tomorrow's report. Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce Jaws of Justice Radio, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live and find podcasts of our show on the KKFI website, that is kkfi.org. We thank our engineer, Beth Pike, for her work today. My name is Melvin Merritt, asking you to tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Claymer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beautician Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Ho. Stick around for jazz and blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musical.